from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I prefer to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution from the standpoint of the slaves, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by black soldiers on Luzon, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on.
As the U.S. empire expands, Howard Zinn sells his millionth copy of People's History of the United States. Today, we'll spend the hour with James Earl Jones, Alice Walker, Kurt Vonnegut, Danny Glover, Alfre Woodard, and others reading from Zinn's classic work. Today, part one. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops opened fire on a crowd of thousands of people in the city of Fallujah, killing three. 15 people were injured. The people were marching to protest an even deadlier shooting on Monday, in which 15 people were killed. The Associated Press is reporting the protesters stopped in front of the U.S. Army's 82nd Airborne Division headquarters. They held signs condemning Monday's shooting and began to throw stones and shoes at the compound. Then the U.S. troops opened fire. Safa Rusli told the Agence France-Presse, quote, "This was a peaceful demonstration. Religious leaders told us not to be armed. There was no exchange of fire." He said U.S. soldiers riding in jeeps and armored vehicles mounted with guns opened fire after children in the crowd started pelting them with shoes and stones. U.S. Intelligence Officer Major Michael Marty claimed U.S. troops were returning fire. In the northern city of Mosul, the New York Times reports 9 people were killed, some 30 injured yesterday, as they celebrated Saddam Hussein's birthday. The Times quotes a doctor as saying more than half the people were killed by gunshots fired in celebration. But U.S. soldiers shot several Iraqis after they said they thought they were coming under attack. A day after the U.S. troops opened fire, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has flown into Iraq and pronounced Iraqis free. Over coffee and biscuits in a Basra airport lounge, Rumsfeld said, quote, "What is significant is that large numbers of human beings, intelligent, energetic, have been liberated." Later, Rumsfeld flew to Baghdad and met top U.S. commanders at a lake palace of Saddam Hussein. British Commander Robin Brim told Rumsfeld it's important to restore services to the Iraqi capital. He said, quote, "I assume forces of badness will try to use infrastructure as a means of discrediting what we're doing to make things better here." Rumsfeld's visit to Iraq comes a day after he met with Saudi Arabia's Prince Sultan bin Abdulaziz and then announced the U.S. will remove almost all of its forces from Saudi Arabia by summer. 500 troops involved in a training program will remain. Saudi Arabia has the largest oil fields in the world. Thousands of U.S. troops have occupied bases in the country since the Gulf War. Saudi Arabia is home to Islam's holiest shrines in Mecca and Medina. And the U.S. troop presence has fueled radical Islam. Osama bin Laden has for years demanded U.S. troops get out of Saudi Arabia. He himself is a Saudi, as were 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers. Meanwhile, a South African TV channel is reporting NATO's Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Europe said the U.S. plans to boost its military presence in Africa. The London-based Arabic newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi is reporting it has a handwritten letter signed by Saddam Hussein urging the Iraqi people to rise up against U.S. troops. The paper quoted sources close to Saddam, confirming it's his own handwriting and signature. High-ranking Iraqi prisoners are uniformly denying Saddam's government had any weapons of mass destruction before the invasion. This, according to U.S. officials familiar with the interrogation quoted by the Associated Press. The U.S. military was accused yesterday of doing nothing to prevent the mass smuggling of Iraq's antiquities. The head of research for the Iraq Museum, Donnie George, told the London Independent anyone can take anything out of the country. He said border checks are only being made on Iraq's western frontier by Jordanian police. British Petroleum yesterday announced its biggest ever profit. The corporation made over $3.5 billion in the first quarter of the year, according, or over $40 million a day. That's more than twice what BP earned in the first quarter of last year. The windfall profit is due to the gas and oil profits, oil prices driven up the invasion of Iraq, as well as disruptions in supply from Nigeria and Venezuela. Hours after the Palestinian parliament voted to confirm Mahmoud Abbas as the first ever Palestinian prime minister, a suicide attack at a popular Tel Aviv cafe killed three people and injured more than 40. A spokesman for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade told the Associated Press the attack was a message to new Palestinian prime minister Mahmoud Abbas that, quote, nobody can disarm the resistance movements without a political solution. You are listening to Democracy Now! War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a special. It's become a classic work of history. It's used in countless schools across the country. It's inspired a generation of historians and students, and it's reshaped how many people view this country's history. We're talking about Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, published 23 years ago. The millionth copy of the book was recently sold. To celebrate this feat, a group of actors, writers, and editors recently gathered at the 92nd Street Y in New York for a public reading of the book. The cast included Alice Walker, Kurt Vonnegut, Danny Glover, James Earl Jones, and many others. We begin with James Earl Jones.
My viewpoint in telling the history of the United States is that we must not accept the memory of states as our own. Nations are not communities and never have been. The history of any country, presented as the history of a family, conceals a fierce conflict of interest. And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, the job of thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, is not to be on the side of the executioners. Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides, which comes from selection and emphasis in history, I prefer to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution from the standpoint of the slaves, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by black soldiers on Luzon, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others. My point is not to grieve for the victims and denounce the executioners. Those tears, that anger, cast into the past, deplete our moral energy for the present. And the lines are not always clear. In the long run, the oppressor is also a victim. In the short run, the victims themselves, desperate and tainted with the culture that oppresses them, turn on other victims. Still, understanding the complexities, this book will be skeptical of governments and their attempts through politics and culture to ensnare ordinary people in a giant web of nationhood pretending to a common interest. I will try not to overlook the cruelties that victims inflict on one another as they are jammed together in the boxcars of the system. I don't want to romanticize them, but I do remember, in rough paraphrase, a statement I once heard. The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is.
Howard Zinn.
Arawak, men and women, naked, tawny, full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the islands, beaches, and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore, carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, gifts. Columbus later wrote of this in his log.
They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears.
Andre Gregory.
Many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, good bodies, handsome features. They did not bear arms and do not know them, for I showed them a sword. They took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance.
Harris Yulin.
They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all, make them do whatever we want.
We have no Indian voices to speak for the men and women of Hispaniola, but we have the volumes written by the Spanish priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, who was an eyewitness to what happened after Columbus came.
That was Howard Zinn, now to Andre Gregory, actor and theater director.
These people are by nature the most humble, patient, and easeable, holding no grudges, free from embroilments, neither excitable nor quarrelsome. These people are the most devoid of rancors, hatred, or desire for vengeance of any people in the world. Yet into this sheepfold, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many days. And Spaniards have behaved in no other way during the past 40 years, down to the present time, for they are still acting like ravening beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native peoples, doing all of this with the strangest and most varied new methods of cruelty never seen or heard of before, and to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so populous, having population that I estimated to be more than 3 millions, has now a population of barely 200 persons.
Howard Zinn.
Our political leaders like to pretend that there are no classes in this country, that all of us have the same interest, Exxon and me, George Bush and you. But we've always had classes in this country, class conflict, class struggle. Before the American Revolution, there were riots of the poor against the rich, of tenants against landlords, flour riots and food riots. During the Revolution, in George Washington's army, there were mutinies of soldiers who resented the privileges of the officer class and the way they themselves were treated, and they mutinied, and then Washington ordered the execution of some of them, execution done by their fellow mutineers. After the war, veterans who had been given small amounts of land found themselves so heavily taxed they couldn't meet their payments. In western Massachusetts, thousands of farmers surrounded the courthouses where their farms were being auctioned off and refused to allow the courts to proceed. Eventually, Shays' Rebellion, as it was called, was crushed. but it put a scare into the founding fathers. And when they met in 1787, a year later, to create a constitution, they made sure to set up a government strong enough to put down the uprisings of the poor. These are the words of one of the participants in Shay's Rebellion, a man named Plow Jogger.
I've labored hard all my days.
Jeff Zenhardson's son.
I've been greatly abused. I've been obliged to do more than my part in the war. Been loaded with class rates, town rates, province rates, continental rates, and all rates. Been pulled and hauled by sheriffs, constables, and collectors. Had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. I've been obliged to pay, and nobody will pay me. I have lost a great deal by this man and that man and t'other man. The great men are going to get all we have. I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it. Have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers. And I know that we are the biggest party. Let them say what they will. We've come to relieve the distresses of the people. There will be no court until they have redress of their grievances.
Howard Zinn.
What is too often overlooked in a triumphal story of the growth of American industry in the 19th century is the human cost of that triumph, the lives cut short, the maimed bodies of the men and women who worked in the factories, the mills. In the Lowell, Massachusetts textile mills of 1836, where girls went to work at the age of 12 and often died by the time they were 25, one of the first strikes of mill girls took place. It is described by one of them, Harriet Hansen.
Actor
when it was
Marissa
announced
Tomei.
That wages were to be cut down, great indignation was felt, and it was decided to strike en masse. This was done. The mills were shut down, and the girls went in procession from their several corporations to the Grove on Chapel Hill and listened to incendiary speeches. One of the girls stood on a pump and gave vent to the feelings of her companions in a neat speech declaring that it was their duty to resist all attempts at cutting down the wages. This was the first time a woman had spoken in public in Lowell, and the event caused surprise and consternation amongst her audience. My own recollection of this first strike, or turnout as it was called, is very vivid. I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempt at oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took side with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, "Would you?" or "Shall we turn out?" and not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who began to think they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, "I don't care what you do, I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not." And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been at any success I may have achieved.
Marissa Tomei joining Jeff Zinn, Andre Gregory, Harris Yulin, James Earl Jones, reading from A People's History of the United States. When we come back, we'll hear from Alfre Woodard, Alice Walker, and others. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! That's Jimmy's Mode, Coltrane, here on The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the reading of People's History of the United States, coming up, Alfre Woodard, Alice Walker, Kurt Vonnegut, Danny Glover, we begin with Howard Zinn.
As part of the long process of driving the Indians off their native lands, Andrew Jackson in the 1830s signed an order to remove by force the five civilized tribes from their territory in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and drive them westward across the Mississippi. There followed what became known as the Trail of Tears, in which 16,000 men, women, children, surrounded by the United States Army, made the long trip westward, and 4,000 of them died. The Cherokees and Seminoles resisted, and here they speak to the government of the United States.
Danny Glover.
We are aware that some persons suppose it will be for our advantage to remove beyond the Mississippi. We think otherwise. Our people universally think otherwise. We wish to remain on the land of our fathers. We have a perfect and original right to remain without interruption or molestation. The treaties with us and the laws of the United States made in pursuance of treaties guarantee our residence and our privileges and secure us against intruders. Our only request is that these treaties may be fulfilled and these laws executed. We entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed to remember the law, the great law of love. Do to others as ye would that others would do to you. We pray them to remember that for the sake of principle, their forefathers were compelled to leave, therefore driven from the old world, and that the winds of persecution rafted them across the great waters and landed them on the shores of the new world, when the Indian was the sole lord and proprietor of these extensive domains. Let them remember in what way they were received by the savage of America when power was in his hand. We were all made by the same great father and are all alike his children. We all come from the same mother and were suckled at the same breast. Therefore, we are brothers, and as brothers should treat together in an amicable way. Your talk is a good one, but my people cannot say they will go. We are not willing to do so. If suddenly we tear our hearts from the homes around which they are twined, our heartstrings will snap.
Howard Zinn.
Women, black and white, played a critical part in the building of the anti-slavery movement in the United States. They worked in anti-slavery societies all over the country, gathering thousands of petitions to Congress. But when in 1840 a World Anti-Slavery Society convention met in London, there was a fierce argument about whether women could attend. The final vote was that they could only attend meetings in a curtained enclosure. They sat in silent protest in the gallery, and when they returned to the United States, they began to lay the basis for the first women's rights convention in history. It was held at Seneca Falls, New York, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton lived as a mother, a housewife, full of resentment at her condition, declaring, "A woman is a nobody. A wife is everything." The convention was attended by 300 women and some men who adopted a declaration of principles, making use of the language and rhythm of the Declaration of Independence.
We hold these truths,
Myla Pitts,
to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it and to insist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers on such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. Man has endeavored in every way that he could to destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life. Now, in view of this entire disfranchisement of one half the people in this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws mentioned above, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States.
Howard Zinn.
Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, once a slave, became a brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. In 1852, he was asked to speak in celebration of the 4th of July.
Fellow citizens.
James Earl Jones.
Pardon me. And allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
John Brown. John Brown. John Brown, more than any other white American, devoted his life and finally sacrificed it on behalf of freedom for the slave. His plan, impossible and courageous, was to seize the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, with a band of black and white abolitionists and set off a revolt of slaves throughout the South. The plan failed. Some of his men, including two of his own sons, were killed. John Brown was wounded, captured, sentenced to death by hanging by the state of Virginia, and with the enthusiastic approval of the government of the United States. When he was put to death, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "He will make the gallows holy as the cross." Here, John Brown addresses the court that ordered his hanging.
Had I interfered in the manner, which I admit, had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any of their friends, or father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right. Every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than of punishment. This court acknowledges, too, as I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed, which I suppose to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament, which teaches me that all things whatsoever I would that men should do to me, I should do even so to them. I endeavored to act up to that instruction. I say I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I've done, as I've always freely admitted I have done, in behalf of his despised poor, I did not wrong, but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country, whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I submit. So let it be done.
Twenty 22 years later, in 1881, Frederick Douglass was asked to speak at a college in Harper's Ferry.
If John Brown did not end the war that ended slavery, he did at least begin the war that ended slavery. If we look over the dates, places, and men for which this honor is claimed, we shall find that not Carolina, but Virginia, not Fort Sumter, but Harper's Ferry and the Arsenal, not Colonel Anderson, but John Brown began the war that ended American slavery and made this a free republic. Until that blow was struck, the prospect of freedom was dim, shadowy, and uncertain. The irrepressible conflict was one of words, votes, and compromises. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared.
After the Civil War, with the federal government enforcing the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, guaranteeing the right to vote to black people, African Americans were elected to governing bodies throughout the South. But after a few years of what might be called radical Reconstruction, the political and business interests of the North made a deal with those of the South to withdraw federal power and allow the white South to have its way. Henry McNeil Turner, elected to the state legislature of Georgia, was expelled by that body in 1872. But before he left, he addressed his colleagues.
Mr. Speaker, I wish the members of this House to understand the position that I take. I hold that I am a member of this body. Therefore, sir, I shall never flaunt or cringe before any party, nor stoop to beg them for my rights. I am here to demand my rights and to hurl thunderbolts at the men who would dare to cross the threshold of my manhood. The scene presented in this House today is one unparalleled in the history of the world. Never in the history of the world has a man been arraigned before a body clothed with legislative, judicial, and executive functions, charged with the offense of being of a darker hue than his fellow men. It has remained for the state of Georgia in the very heart of the 19th century to call a man before the bar and there charge him with an act for which he is no more responsible than the head which carries upon his shoulders. The Anglo-Saxon race, sir, is a most surprising one. I was not aware that there was in the character of the race so much cowardice or so much pusillanimity. I tell you, sir, that this is a question which will not die today. This event shall be remembered for prosperity for ages yet to come. And while the sun shall continue to climb the hills of heaven, we are told that if black men want to speak, they must speak through white trumpets. If black me wants their men, once their sentiments expressed, they must be adulterated and sent through white messengers who will quibble and equivocate and evade as rapidly as the pendulum of a clock. The great question, sir, is this: am I a man? If I am such, I claim the rights of a man. Why, sir, though we are not white, we have accomplished much. We have built up your country. We have worked in your fields and garnered your harvests for 250 years. And what do we as asked of you in return? Do we ask you for compensation for the sweat of our fathers they bore for you, for the tears that have caused, and for the hearts you have broken, and the lives you have curtailed, and the blood you have spilled? Do we ask retaliation? We asked it not. We are willing to let the dead pass buried is dead, but we ask you now for our rights.
Danny Glover, James Earl Jones, Harris Yulin, and others reading from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. When we come back from our break, we'll hear from, among others, Alice Walker and Alfre Woodard and Kurt Vonnegut. Stay with us. You're listening to Coltrane here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to this historic reading that took place at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan on the occasion of the millionth sale of A People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn's classic work. Among those who read Alfre Woodard and Alice Walker, Howard Zinn introduced the next segment.
The orthodox texts in American history pay much attention to what was called a splendid little war, the victory of the United States in the three-month-long Spanish-American War of 1898. But these texts slide quickly over the bloody conquest of the Philippines that went on for years, which President McKinley said was necessary to civilize and Christianize the Filipinos, and which Theodore Roosevelt hailed as the newest outpost of the American Empire. Roosevelt loved war and militarism, and when the army massacred 600 Moros on a southern island in the Philippines in 1906, Roosevelt congratulated the commanding general. Here is Mark Twain's response.
This incident burst upon the world last Friday.
Kurt Vonnegut.
In an official cablegram from the commander of our forces in the Philippines to our government at Washington. The substance of it was as follows. A tribe of Moros, dark-skinned savages, had fortified themselves in the bowl of an extinct crater not many miles from Jolo. And as they were hostiles and bitter against us because we've been trying for 8 years to take their liberties away from them, their presence in that position was a menace. Our commander, General Leonard Wood, ordered a reconnaissance. It was found that the Moros numbered 600, counting women and children, and their crater bowl was in the summit of a peak or mountain 2,200 feet above sea level, and very difficult of access for Christian troops and artillery. Then General Wood ordered a surprise and went along himself to see the order carried out. General Wood's order was kill or capture the 600. There, with 600 engaged on each side, we lost 15 men killed outright, and we had 32 wounded, counting that nose and that elbow. The enemy numbered 600, including women and children, and we abolished them utterly, leaving not even a baby alive to cry for its dead mother. This is incomparably the greatest victory that was ever achieved by the Christian soldiers of the United States. So far as I can find out, there was only one person among our 80 millions who allowed himself the privilege of a public remark on this great occasion. That was the President of the United States. All day Friday, he was studiously silent as the rest, but on Saturday, he recognized that his duty required him to say something, and he took his pen and performed that duty. This is what he said. Washington, March 10th, to General Wood, Manila. I congratulate you and the officers and men of your command upon the brilliant feat of arms wherein you and they so well upheld the honor of the American flag. Signed, Theodore Roosevelt. I have read carefully the Treaty of Paris. I have seen that we do not intend to free, but to subjugate the people of the Philippines. We have gone there to conquer, not to redeem. It should, it seems to me, be our pleasure and duty to make these people free and let them deal with their own domestic questions in their own way. And so, I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land.
The IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, was a radical labor organization of the early 20th century. It organized all workers, black, white, men, women, native-born, foreign, skilled, unskilled, which the American Federation of Labor refused to do. Its goal was revolutionary, to take over the industrial system and run it for the benefit of the people. When immigrant women in the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike in 1912, they were met with police violence and judicial intimidation. The IWW poet and organizer, Arturo Giovannitti, was arrested on spurious charges for murder. Here is his speech to the jury, which found him innocent.
Mr. Foreman and gentlemen of the jury, it is the first time in my life that I speak publicly in your wonderful language, and it is the most solemn moment in my life. There has been brought only one side of this great industrial question, only the method and only the tactics, but what about the ethical part of the question? What about the better and nobler humanity, where there shall be no more slaves, where no man will ever be obliged to go on strike in order to obtain 50 cents a week more, where children will not have to starve anymore, where women no more will have to go and prostitute themselves, where at last there will not be any more slaves, any more masters, but just one great family of friends and brothers. They say you are free in this great and wonderful country. I say that politically you are, and my best compliments and congratulations. But I say you cannot be half free and half slave. And economically, all the working class in the United States are as much slaves now as the Negroes were 40 and 50 years ago. Because the man that owns the tool where another man works, the man that owns the house where this man lives, the man that owns the factory where this man wants to go to work, that man owns and controls the bread that that man eats, and therefore owns and controls his mind, his body, his heart, and his soul. I am 29 years old. Not quite. I have a woman that loves me and that I love. I have a mother and father that are waiting for me. I have an ideal that is dear to me that can be expressed or understood. And life has so many allurements, and it is so nice and so bright and so wonderful that I felt the passion of living in my heart, and I do want to live. Whichever way you judge, gentlemen of the jury, I thank you.
Oh.
That was Jeff Zinn. This is his father, Howard Zinn.
In the year 1914, 1,000 miners with wives and children who had gone on strike against the Rockefeller-owned coal mines in southern Colorado were holding out in a tent colony near the tiny hamlet of Ludlow. One day in April, the National Guard, financed by Rockefeller, began pouring machine gun fire into the tent colony and then came down from the hills and set fire to the tents. The next day, the bodies of 11 children and 2 women were found, suffocated, burned to death. This became known as the Ludlow Massacre. Mother Mary Jones, 82-year-old organizer for the mine workers, had come to Colorado to support the miners, and on the eve of their strike, as they gathered in the opera house in Trinidad, she spoke to them.
Alfred Woodard.
What would the coal in the mines be worth if you did not work to take it out? The time is ripe for you to stand like men. I know something about strikes. I didn't go into them yesterday. I was carried 84 miles and landed in jail by a United States Marshal in the night because I was talking to a miners' meeting. The next morning I was brought to court and the judge said to me, "Did you read my injunction? Did you understand that the injunction told you not to look at the miners? As long as the judge who is higher than you leaves me sight, I will look at anything I want to," said I. The old judge died soon after that, and the injunction died with him. At another time, when in the courtroom, the bailiff said to me, "When you are addressing the court, you must say your honor." "I don't know whether he has any or not," said I. Someone said to me, "You don't believe in charity work, mother?" "No, I don't believe in charity. It is a vice. We need the upbuilding of justice to mankind. We don't need your charity. All we need is an opportunity to live like men and women in this country. I want you to pledge yourselves in this convention to stand as one solid army against the foes of human labor. Think of the thousands who are killed every day, and there is no redress for it. We will fight until the mines are made secure and human life valued more than props. Look things in the face. Don't fear a governor. Don't fear anybody. You pay the governor. He has a right to protect you. You are the biggest part of this population, the biggest part of the population in this state. You create its wealth. So I say, let the fight go on. If anybody else, nobody else will keep on. I will."
Well, Emma Goldman. Emma Goldman, in the early part of the 20th century, became one of the most powerful voices in America for anarchism, feminism, the rights of working people. She lectured all over the country on women's rights, on the theater of Shaw, Ibsen, Strindberg, on patriotism and war. She was arrested many times. She was jailed for opposing World War I and then was deported under the personal supervision of J. Edgar Hoover. Here in the year 1916, she addresses a courtroom where she has been charged with speaking about birth control.
"Your Honor, I am charged with the crime of having given information to men and women as to how to prevent conception. For the last 3 weeks, every night before packed houses, a stirring social indictment is being played at the Candler Theater. I refer to Justice by John Galsworthy. The counsel for the defense, in summing up the charge against the defendant, says, among other things, 'Your Honor, back of the commission of every crime is life, palpitating life.' Now, what is the palpitating life back of my crime? I will tell you, Your Honor. According to the bulletin of the Department of Health, 30 million people in America are underfed. Your Honor, what kind of children do you suppose these parents can bring into the world? I will tell you, children so poor and anemic that they take their leave of this, our kind world, before their first year of life. In that way, 300,000 babies, according to the Baby Welfare Association, are sacrificed in the United States every year. This, Your Honor, is the palpitating life which has confronted me for many years, and which is back of the commission of my crime. After all, the question of birth control is largely a working man's question, above all, a working woman's question. She it is who risks her health, her youth, her very life, in giving out of herself the units of the race. She it is who ought to have the means and the knowledge to say how many children she will have, and to what purpose she shall have them, and under what conditions she shall bring forth life. And this is true not only because of what I say or may not say. There is much profounder reason for the tremendous growth and importance of birth control. The reason is conditioned in the great modern social conflict, or rather social war, I might say. A war not for military conquest or material supremacy, a war of the oppressed and disinherited of the earth against their enemies, capitalism and the state. A war for a seat at the table of life, a war for well-being, for beauty, for liberty. Above all, this is a war for a free motherhood and a joyous, playful, glorious childhood.
Alice Walker reading Emma Goldman from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, Part 2 tomorrow, here on Democracy Now! A historic reading as Howard Zinn sells the millionth copy of this classic grassroots history. And that does it for today's program. Our website is www.democracynow.org, that event, the 92nd Street Y in New York. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Raiba and Vilka Suris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Fatima Mojadidi, Karen Renucci, Dennis Moynihan, and Alex Wolf. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The war is taking a lot out of the budgets of the city. And you can't help anybody else if you can't help your own. And we're making a statement that we have to have a living wage.
Budgeting for war. Who pays? Then, is a new nuclear arms race going to begin? We go to Geneva, where a major conference on nuclear nonproliferation is taking place, and hear a speech from Jonathan Schell, one of the leading advocates for the abolition of nuclear weapons. We'll also speak with a Belgian lawyer preparing to sue General Franks for war crimes in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Thank you. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops opened fire today in a crowd of thousands of people in the city of Fallujah, killing three people. At least 15 people are injured. People were marching to protest an even deadlier shooting on Monday, in which 15 people were killed. The Associated Press is reporting the protesters stopped in front of the U.S. Army's 82nd Airborne Division headquarters. They held signs condemning Monday's shooting and began to throw stones and shoes at the compound. Then the U.S. troops opened fire. Safa Rusli told the Agence France-Presse, quote, "This was a peaceful demonstration. Religious leaders told us not to be armed. There was no exchange of gunfire." U.S. intelligence officer Major Michael Marty claimed U.S. troops were returning fire. Muslim religious leaders told the AFP today they met with U.S. forces after the killings today and asked U.S. forces to pull back from the city. The city's top religious leader, Sheikh Waga Ali al-Mohammadi, said, quote, "Fallujah is known as a center of Islam. We care about religion. We care about our honor and our land. We told them things will get worse and worse." An imam who also attended the meeting said they've opted for diplomatic means up to now, but it will be difficult to contain the people for long. In the northern city of Mosul, the New York Times reports 9 people were killed and some 30 injured as they celebrated Saddam Hussein's birthday. The Times quotes a doctor as saying more than half the people were killed by gunshots fired in celebration. But U.S. soldiers shot several Iraqis after they said they thought they were coming under attack. As the troops opened fire on the people in Fallujah, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld flew into Iraq, pronouncing the Iraqi people free. Over coffee and biscuits in a Basra airport lounge, Rumsfeld said, quote, "What is significant is that large numbers of human beings, intelligent, energetic, have been liberated." Later, Rumsfeld flew to Baghdad and met top U.S. commanders at a lake palace of Saddam Hussein. British Commander Robin Brim told Rumsfeld, "It's important to restore services to the Iraqi capital." He said, quote, "I assume forces of badness will try to use infrastructure as a means of discrediting what we're doing to make things better here." Rumsfeld's visit to Iraq comes a day after he met with Saudi Arabia's Prince Sultan bin Abdul Aziz and then announced the U.S. will remove almost all its forces from Saudi Arabia by this summer. 500 troops involved in a training program will remain. Saudi Arabia has the largest oil fields in the world. Thousands of U.S. troops have occupied bases in the country since the Gulf War. Saudi Arabia is home to Islam's holiest shrines in Mecca and Medina, and the U.S. troop presence has fueled radical Islam. Osama bin Laden has for years called on Muslims around the globe to expel U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden himself is a Saudi, as were 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers. Meanwhile, a South African TV channel is reporting NATO's supreme commander of allied forces in Europe said the U.S. plans to boost its military presence in Africa as Africa becomes more of a focus. The London-based Arabic newspaper Al Quds Al Arabi is reporting it has a handwritten letter signed by Saddam Hussein urging the Iraqi people to rise up against U.S. troops. The paper quoted sources close to Saddam, confirming it is his own handwriting and signature. Yesterday, Al Quds Al Arabi published a letter from a previously unknown group calling itself Iraqi Resistance and Liberation. The group said Saddam was still alive and would deliver a message to his country within days. High-ranking Iraqi prisoners are uniformly denying Saddam's government had any weapons of mass destruction before the war. This, according to U.S. officials familiar with their interrogations, quoted in the Associated Press. The U.S. military was yesterday accused of doing nothing to prevent the mass smuggling of Iraq's antiquities. The head of research for the Iraq Museum, Donnie George, told the London Independent that anyone can take anything out of the country. He said border checks are only being conducted on Iraq's western frontier by Jordanian police. Editor and Publisher magazine is reporting members of the Western press in Iraq are fueling anti-American sentiment. In one incident, Los Angeles Times reporter Jeffrey Mohn walked to the driver's window of a destroyed minibus in central Baghdad. Inside the broken window was the carbonized corpse of the vehicle's driver, its charred arm resting on the window's ledge. Mohn asked a photographer to take his photo as he stood about a foot from the corpse, and with his pen poised over his notebook, asked the corpse, quote, "Well, sir, do you have any comment on what has happened to you here?" 30 feet away, 20 Iraqis stood watching the American conduct a mock interview with the corpse of a man who probably had a family for a photo op. Mohan was embedded with an army unit. He later acknowledged the incident was a, quote, ill-conceived, clumsy, and ill-considered attempt at gallows humor. He described the account by Australian reporter Peter Wilson and the two other eyewitnesses as part of, quote, an agenda against embedded reporters. High-ranking Iraqi prisoners are uniformly denying Saddam's government had any weapons of mass destruction before the war. The U.S. military was yesterday accused of doing nothing to prevent the mass smuggling of Iraq's antiquities. A U.S. official met yesterday with Iraq's two most senior deputy oil ministers for the first time. Gary Vogler warned them not to make any changes in their hierarchy without U.S. approval. One Iraqi oil official told the New York Times the main question is whether Iraq's oil will remain in state hands or whether it will be privatized. Meanwhile, British Petroleum yesterday announced its biggest ever profit. The corporation made over $3.5 billion in the first quarter of the year, or over $40 million a day. That's more than twice what BP earned in the first quarter of last year. The windfall profit is due to the gas and oil prices driven up by the invasion of Iraq, as well as disruptions in supply from Nigeria and Venezuela. Hours after the Palestinian parliament voted to confirm Mahmoud Abbas as the first ever Palestinian prime minister, a suicide attack at a popular Tel Aviv cafe killed three people, including the suicide bomber, and injured more than 40 others. A spokesperson for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade told Associated Press the attack was a message to new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas that nobody can disarm the resistance movements without a political solution. Before the attack, Abbas forcefully denounced terrorism in an address to the parliament. He also said Israel must abandon settlements and end its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip to achieve a lasting peace. Envoys from the United Nations, European Union, and Russia are presenting the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace to Abbas today. Meanwhile, the AP reports Israeli soldiers mark numbers in ink on the hands of hundreds of Palestinians waiting online at a crowded military checkpoint on Monday. The army confirmed the incident, but claimed it was done by a lone soldier who acted on his own and would face a disciplinary hearing. A similar incident happened in March of 2001 when soldiers marked numbers on the foreheads and forearms of Palestinian detainees awaiting interrogation during an army sweep of a West Bank refugee camp. At the time, the action drew outrage from an Israeli lawmaker who survived the Holocaust. During World War II, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, most of them Jews, had numbers tattooed on their forearms. The practice of doing the same to Palestinians, the army said, was halted. The Supreme Court ruled by 5-4 yesterday that the government must detain immigrants, including permanent residents, who've committed certain crimes while the federal government decides whether to deport them. The Washington Post reports the ruling confirms Congress's power to limit the rights of even relatively well-established non-citizens. The decision puts the nation's estimated 11 million permanent residents, immigrants, or green card holders on notice. If they commit aggravated offenses or offenses of so-called moral turpitude, they'll serve their sentences and then be locked up again by immigration authorities if removal proceedings against them are pending. Four federal appeals courts had declared the mandatory detention provision for permanent residents unconstitutional. Civil libertarians, immigrant rights groups, the American Bar Association, and prominent former immigration officials had urged the court to rule that the Constitution requires giving criminals who are permanent resident immigrants a hearing. But Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote, quote, "This court has firmly and repeatedly endorsed the proposition that Congress may make rules as to aliens that would be unacceptable if applied to citizens." He was backed by Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas. Talks are being held between Nigerian union leaders and a Houston-based oil company aimed at ending a hostage crisis in Nigeria. Striking Nigerian oil workers have taken nearly 100 hostages, including 21 Americans, on several offshore oil rigs. The rigs are owned by Houston-based Transocean and were drilling wells on behalf of oil multinationals Royal Dutch Shell and Total Fina Elf. As the Chinese Health Ministry announced 11 new deaths and over 150 new cases of SARS, the New York Times reports SARS has almost reached the top of the government hierarchy. Authorities have quarantined an unknown number of people inside President Hu Jintao's leadership compound. The virus has infected the executive director of the largest government-owned financial conglomerate and at least four people at the Commerce Ministry. Canada managed to lift a travel advisory on the city of Toronto after the city went for 5 days without any locally transmitted cases of SARS. The Washington Post reports the U.S. government has launched a broad effort to develop vaccines and drugs against the SARS virus. The National Institutes of Health is preparing to make money available because many private drug companies are hesitant to invest heavily in SARS research before it's clear whether SARS will be a long-lasting and widespread phenomenon.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. The headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own? Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? There are lives in the balance. There are people under fire.
Lives in the Balance, Richie Havens here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea said today it will regard any U.S. move to seek U.N. sanctions as, quote, the green light to a war. The official North Korean news agency said the country will take defensive measures. The warning came after the White House yesterday rejected North Korea's offer to scrap its nuclear program, stop selling ballistic missiles, and readmit UN inspectors. North Korea said it would disarm after the U.S. provides a guarantee that it will not attack and resume shipments of oil and food aid. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said Pyongyang will not be rewarded for, quote, bad behavior. Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, quote, we will not be intimidated by their claims and threats. As the president has said, we will not be blackmailed. All of this comes as the nearly 200 nations who have signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty are meeting in Geneva to review the implementation of the 1970 Pact. In an address to the gathering on opening day, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation, John Wolf, criticized North Korea's withdrawal from the treaty and accused Iran of secretly developing nuclear weapons. Disarmament experts say the risk of nuclear proliferation are worse now than they were for the last 50 years. They say Washington's lack of commitment to non-proliferation is as damaging as the behavior of the proliferators. We're joined now by Rebecca Johnson, director of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy. She's in Geneva covering the talks for the Institute's journal, Disarmament Diplomacy. And she has been in meetings all day. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us, Rebecca Johnson. Well, can you talk now about the first addresses of the nuclear weapons owning states and what those addresses have been, particularly the United States, and what they mean?
Yes. I should say at the outset that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty enshrined two kinds of bargain, and a very central part of it was that in return for agreeing not to try to develop or acquire nuclear weapons by 182 countries in the world, the five that already had them by the year 1967 agreed that they would progressively get rid of their nuclear weapons and eliminate their nuclear arsenals. So it's in that context that the states meeting here in Geneva were very surprised to find that the United States focused almost exclusively on North Korea, Iran, Iraq, and also mentioned Libya and Syria as threatening the non-proliferation regime. Now, clearly, all of those countries have serious questions to answer, but the United States itself is not in full compliance with its own obligations under this treaty, or indeed under several other treaties, and has so far refused to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That was a very central part of the commitments undertaken in 1995 when the treaty was made permanent. So a number of worries are raised by the statement that was made by Assistant Secretary of State John Wolf in relation to North Korea, where he said that although the United States was determined to end North Korea's threat through peaceful diplomatic means, he also stated all our options remain available. I think it's in that context that a number of countries here are very concerned that the United States might be looking to take military means with regard to North Korea, which would be profoundly destabilizing for the whole North Asian region.
In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, Bush signed the National Security Presidential Directive 17, which stated, quote, "The United States will continue to make clear it reserves the right to respond with overwhelming force, including potentially nuclear weapons, to the use of weapons of mass destruction against the United States." How does that weigh in here?
Well, it weighs very, very badly, because also as part of this treaty, the United States and the other nuclear weapon states agree to what are called security assurances, and by those they promise that they will not use nuclear weapons in any attack on any non-nuclear weapon state party to the treaty. Now, although North Korea has announced that it wants to withdraw from the treaty, the states parties to the treaty here in Geneva have refused to accept that, and the question is still actually unresolved. So there's a legal question about whether this kind of threat can ever be justified, and the states parties here are saying it cannot ever be justified in this day and age. But secondly, there is the commitment that in relation to this treaty, not to threaten states that are non-nuclear weapon-owning parties to the treaty with nuclear weapons. And you know, it's just logical. If you have states that say we will not ever acquire nuclear weapons, they need to be assured that they won't be attacked with them. And what's happening as a result of the Bush administration's policy is that in attacking Iraq in the way that they did, in a sense, they provided an appalling advertisement to would-be proliferators, but also to national leaders who wanted to prevent the United States from ever trying to interfere in their affairs and threaten them with nuclear weapons by making it clear that any state that already had nuclear weapons would somehow manage to deter the United States. Now, that's a very, very dangerous precedent for the United States to be setting. They are really, at this point, their policies are damaging and seriously eroding international law and the international treaty-based system of relations for trying to find peaceful ways of dealing with conflicts and dealing with states such as North Korea that are trying to hedge their bets with regard to nuclear weapons.
We're talking to Rebecca Johnson, director of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy. Can you talk about the meetings that you've been in today and whether conferences like these, the conference that you're attending in Geneva right now on nuclear nonproliferation, matter at all?
I think these treaties matter a very great deal. Without international law, we would have a nuclear free-for-all. You know, President Kennedy said back in the early 60s that he expected to see 20, 25 countries with nuclear weapons and an incredible insecurity as a result. It was precisely because he had that fear that he ensured that the United States went into negotiations with the Soviet Union that ended up after, you know, his time, but ended up under the subsequent president with the treaty nuclear non-proliferation, of which nuclear disarmament was a very, very important part. And the other treaties, like the Biological Weapons Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Treaty, these completely prohibit, eliminate, and ban the possession or the production of biological and chemical weapons. But, of course, they have to be verified. And when you get a country such as the United States, the most powerful country on the world, wanting all of these treaties restrictions to be applied to other countries, to weaker countries, but refuse to accept reciprocal constraints on their own manufacturing and weapons development capabilities, then they make a nonsense of the idea that the international law, as with your own domestic law, needs to be applied without regard to kind of status or size. It's the equivalent of a judge who pronounces on the crimes of others and then goes out and kills people with drunken driving. Of course that judge has to be under the law, as the United States must be under the law if it wants this law, these laws, to be applied to proliferation states and also to terrorist actors.
Let me ask you this. Senator Edward Kennedy warned that the Bush administration is preparing to restart the testing of nuclear weapons so it could develop a new generation of bunker-busting bombs and tactical mini-nukes, potentially triggering a new arms race. And then you have Dr. Sidney Drell, who is a theoretical physicist who once served as a consultant to Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and currently sits on the National Nuclear Security Administration Advisory Committee, saying it's unlikely that so-called nuclear bunker busters will ever penetrate far enough into the Earth to prevent massive radioactive fallout. He said in order to destroy the most worrisome underground targets, which are believed to be at depths of some 1,000 feet, the U.S. would need a bomb 10 times the strength of the one that was dropped on Hiroshima. Drell said, we're not talking about low collateral damage, low yield weapons. That is a physical myth. Are these so-called mini nukes included in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Absolutely, yes. Not only are they included, all nuclear weapons of whatever size are included under this treaty, but not only that, but as part of the agreement to extend the treaty in 1995, the U.S. and indeed all the other countries there agreed to conclude a comprehensive nuclear test ban by 1996, and at that time, the Assistant Secretary of State spoke publicly here at the UN in Geneva and promised that as a result of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the United States would not develop mini-nukes or micro-nukes or any of these other destabilizing new tactical-type developments. He promised that no new nuclear weapons would be developed. Now, the United States is it was the first country to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1996, and it still has not ratified. And that is causing immense dismay here. There are some very real concerns about the developments. And Sidney Drell is absolutely correct. I mean, who should know better than he with his experiences? These deep penetrating warheads are presented by politicians as if they're going to burrow deep in the ground and be the equivalent of a deep underground nuclear test that would somehow be contained. That is not the case. They would be the equivalent of virtually an above ground detonation, in that they would lift large amounts of earth and whatever was on top of them high into the sky in a devastating mushroom cloud that would contaminate and kill for miles around the area in which they had so-called penetrated. This is the reality of those so-called mini-nukes. They would be a nuclear weapon that would result in a mushroom cloud and a large number of deaths. So if the United States really wants to address the terrorist uses of nuclear weapons and terrorist acquisition, if it's really serious about wanting to stop these weapons getting into the hands of any malign terrorist or leader, then they have to pursue a comprehensive policy of disarmament and verified elimination of the weapons and of the materials that are used to produce them. And for the United States, of all countries, with its still some 30,000 nuclear weapons, many of which may be in storage but are perfectly usable, for the United States to say that it has not got enough nuclear weapons and it needs more and newer developments makes a mockery of the notion of preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Rebecca Johnson, I want to thank you very much for being with us, director of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy in Geneva, to cover the talks for the Institute's journal Disarmament Diplomacy. Website www.acronym.org.uk. When we come back, we're going to Iraq. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to Fallujah, U.S. troops today fired into a crowd of thousands of people in the city of Fallujah, killing three people. At least 15 are in a serious condition in the hospital. The people were marching to protest an even deadlier shooting on Monday in which 15 people were killed. We're going to turn now to Sophie Claudette, who is an Agence France-Presse reporter on the ground in Fallujah. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sophie.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you tell us what happened?
Hello?
Can you tell us what happened?
Okay. First of all, sorry, but the line is very bad, so I hope you can hear me. What happened is this morning, I didn't myself witness the incident during which three people were shot dead by American forces, apparently, according to eyewitness reports. What I saw for myself is a heavy American presence throughout the city, including tanks and APCs and heavily armed U.S. forces on the ground, a very hostile and tense population, very tense U.S. troops. What I could confirm, according to medical sources, that three people were killed, according to residents in the area, including newly appointed official medical sources and religious authorities, the demonstrators were not armed. And they say that the American troops fired at them randomly, killing three people and injuring many others. To you.
I actually saw on CNN, they said the people killed were boys under 11. Is that the case?
Can you say it again? I can hear.
The age of the people killed, were they under 11?
I cannot confirm that report.
Uh-huh.
I do not know. All I can tell you is that people were protesting the killing of yet another 13 Iraqis 2 days before in that same city. And that's why they staged this demonstration, which according to eyewitness reports was a peaceful demonstration. Three people were killed. I'm actually now following the funeral of two of those killed this morning. The third person was buried earlier today.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe the procession?
People are quite angry. I mean, for the time being, there is no political slogans, there is no God but God, the usual, Muslim phrase. But we can feel that the atmosphere is quite tense in the city, and people, then again, these are just predictions, but people are saying that things could get much worse tonight. Then again, people are protesting the killing of 13 of their fellow citizens 2 days ago. They're protesting the presence of U.S. forces here inside of the city. It's a very conservative city, as a matter of fact. And they're saying that the presence of American troops in their city is corrupting the youth and girls in the city. They're asking, however, that they're not asking for a full withdrawal. They're asking for the U.S. troops to withdraw to the outskirts of the city, because they realize that American troops are also essential to provide security in the absence of a local police force.
So the Muslim religious leaders have met with U.S. forces?
They have not, what did you say, welcome U.S. forces?
Met.
Well, people, on the one hand, people are thankful here, it seems, that the old regime was toppled. And they're not asking for the religious authorities and the newly appointed governor or representative for the governor here is not asking for a full withdrawal. They're asking that the U.S. forces be not visible, if you will, inside of the city, because they feel, you know, it's a conservative city and they're not, their presence is leading to this kind of demonstration, clashes, and so on. However, they're saying that an American presence, until security is not reestablished, is also essential, as long as it's not visible.
CENTCOM today, CENTCOM said in a statement that in Fallujah, Iraqi civilians throwing rocks and firing weapons attacked a convoy. The convoy returned fire, and the crowd was dispersed by the arrival of coalition helicopters. Do you dispute this, Sophie Claudette? Sophie, are you there? Well, it looks like we've lost her. Sophie Claudette speaking to us from Fallujah. She is a reporter with Agence France-Presse. Her reports disputing, clearly, what the U.S. Central Command has said. Again, the latest fatalities, 3 dead in Fallujah, 2 critically wounded, and 15 in the hospital at this point. When U.S. troops opened fire, they were protesting the killing of 15 people. The U.S. troops shooting dead 15 people between 13 and 15 on Monday in Fallujah. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Jonathan Schell. Jonathan Schell, following up on the story we brought you from Geneva, is well known for his advocacy of the abolition of nuclear weapons. He is the author of The Gift of Time, The Case for Abolishing Nuclear Weapons Now, and The Fate of the Earth. Jonathan Schell spoke recently in New York at New York University Law School.
I'd say it seems on the face of it that we face a potential nuclear confrontation between what appear to be two of the most stubborn regimes on the face of this earth. Each is a specialist in not backing down. And it seems to me that there are only two outcomes that seem very likely here, and it's hard to imagine what's going to happen in either case. And the first is that that North Korea goes ahead and builds its nuclear arsenal. It may or may not have one or two bombs already. The administration says it does, but there's a certain cloudiness surrounding that claim. In which case, the Bush administration will either have to accept it or go to war. Now, if they accept it, they will have to swallow several reams of public statements by the president and all his cabinet officials. They have backed themselves into one of the tightest policy corners that any administration has ever been in. Now, the second possibility here is that North Korea will scrap its nuclear program, and that too seems unlikely. And the third possibility is, of course, war, with the horrifying casualties that Bruce Cummings mentioned, and that would certainly make the Iraq War look like a tea party by comparison. Now, there may be a way of squaring this circle, I don't know, and that's one thing I'd like to be hearing from the panels and those of you in the room. Now, I want to talk about the policy context here for a moment. We've just finished a war, and when you're dealing with wars, it's especially important to consider the justification, because a war is not a budget regulation or a bench appointment. It is killing and it is death. Every war starts off wrong and only becomes acceptable, if that ever happens, with the most compelling and extreme justification or emergency. Ernest Hemingway said that every war, even when it is justified, is a crime, which is a thought I think is worth pondering. Now, in this case, the justification of the Iraq War, as of the possible war that looms in the future, has been in North Korea, or against North Korea, has been stated with exceptional clarity by the administration. Just to quote one of the statements that the president has made, out of many that I could quote, he said, I quote now, "The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons." Now, those are the words of an ultimatum. When a great power says, "will not permit," that is an ultimatum. And so this policy has everything to do with weapons of mass destruction. That has been the constant theme at the UN, where the resolution 1441 was put forward, in all of the statements of the administration. This has been the stated justification. And so really the Iraq War was the first of what I like to call disarmament wars. This is something new on the face of the earth. War waged for the purpose of taking a certain category of weapon away from another country or several other countries. And Iraq was the first one, and they've done it, although as a matter of fact, they never did find any weapons of mass destruction. We'll see what happens there. Now, the means were also stated with great clarity, and they've already been mentioned. They were preemptive war, really meaning preventive war, or to use a good old-fashioned term, aggression. The president stated clearly that containment and deterrence were things of the past, that those belonged to the Cold War, and we were in an entirely new age, and we had to rewrite the rule book, and now it was going to be first use, attack, striking before the danger even arises. Also, the doctrine or vision in which this goal has been put forward and these means adopted was put forward with equal clarity. And that was to achieve the global hegemonic military superiority of the United States over all other countries on the earth. Now, this isn't just something that you have to read The Nation magazine to find out. It's right there in repeated statements by the White House and the President. I'll just quote one more. America has and intends to keep military strengths beyond challenge, thereby making the destabilizing arms races of other eras pointless and limiting rivalries to trade and other pursuits of peace. Thus the President of the United States. Now think about that for a moment. On the one side, you have the United States. It's in charge of the entire military sphere. Not only is it dominant, but it is so thoroughly dominant in the president's view that all other countries should just get out of that business. All the military history of the past several thousand years is now to be ended, and all other countries to get out of that business, and they're just going to go to the movies or buy and sell or whatever he means by limiting rivalries to trade and other pursuits of peace. Now, this is a very radical policy. And on the eve of the Iraq War, and this applies with a special pertinence to the North Korean situation, the president said that it would be, I quote, suicide. He used the word suicide to let a regime survive if the United States surmised that from 1 to 5 years down the road, they might possess weapons of mass destruction. Now, gang members will attack you if you look at them the wrong way. The United States has gone one better here and said that we will attack you if you merely think about us in the wrong way, or if we think you're thinking about us in the wrong way, or you may do so 5 years hence. So that's the policy, those are the means, and that's the vision, and all of it applies four square, even more so to North Korea than it did to Iraq, because North Korea is actually believed, according to administration statements, actually to possess one or two nuclear weapons, to have very active programs for obtaining more. We can't weigh the truthfulness of those. It's a little hard to tell, but that's what they say. So we have to remind ourselves in thinking about this policy, what is proliferation? Proliferation is not a tank division crossing a desert. Above all, it's a transfer of knowledge, of scientific ideas and blueprints. It can happen over the internet. And by the way, we are reminded that North Korea obtained the know-how for its new uranium enrichment program from our old friend Pakistan. It was quietly done when the chief scientist of the Pakistani nuclear program made a couple of visits to North Korea and got back a new missile, which Pakistan promptly built and deployed. Now, there have been a couple of ideas for dealing with nuclear proliferation and nuclear danger historically. I'll just list them very quickly. One of them is the abolition of nuclear weapons. And actually, President Truman was in favor of that in 1946. Of course, we know it didn't happen. It was rejected by the Soviet Union. Soviet Union put forward a plan, and this too was rejected, and we were off to the arms races. However, that idea did survive in the form of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which embraces that goal, and under which actually 182 nations actually have agreed to forego nuclear weapons. That's a tremendous accomplishment. That's a terrific piece of diplomacy. The second one was the idea of nuclear deterrence, which grew up in the Cold War and now has been discarded by the president. And the idea of nuclear deterrence, of course, is that if you want to be safe from nuclear weapons, then get nuclear weapons. That's the lesson the United States and the other nuclear powers have been teaching the world with every single action and statement they've made since 1945 down to the present. And that is the lesson that North Korea has learned. They are threatened with nuclear weapons, with threatened first strike by the United States, indeed, made very clear in its documents, as Bruce Cummings mentioned, and so they have moved to obtain this themselves, just as the United States did when it thought it might, way back in 1945, be one day threatened by Hitler. So we can state deterrence is an engine of proliferation, because its core idea is that you win safety by getting nuclear weapons in face of a nuclear threat. And that engine has produced the proliferation in Pakistan, India, and now in North Korea. Now I come to the final idea, which has been only an idea down to the present, and that's the idea of preemption or prevention. And I'd just like to
quote one more comment here. This is what, it has been rejected by every single president of the nuclear age down to the present office holder, but not including him. Here's what Eisenhower had to say about it. All of us have heard this term preventive war since the earliest days of Hitler. I recall that is about the first time he heard it, so he identifies whose idea that was in his mind. In this day and time, if we believe for one second that nuclear fission and fusion, that type of weapon, would be used in such a war, what is a preventive war? I don't believe there is such a thing, and frankly, I wouldn't even listen to anyone seriously that came in and talked about such a thing. Thus, President Dwight D. Eisenhower. But now that thing that he wouldn't even listen to is the policy of the United States. It's a very radical revolution. Well, I'll just comment, I'm going to skip over here a little bit in the interest of time. I'll just comment that prevention is an even more efficient engine for proliferation than deterrence is, because it actually threatens governments that they will actually be destroyed. And Donald Rumsfeld, of course, did that in a memo that he circulated just last week, saying that China and the United States should now seek regime change in North Korea, as if to turn the screws one more notch, in case they hadn't gotten the point already. Now, one last comment here. Historically speaking, nations that obtain nuclear weapons have almost never reversed course and gotten rid of them. There's only one instance in the nuclear age, and that was South Africa, which of course was facing regime change from the white minority government to the black majority government, and thus had a highly particular reason for getting rid of its nuclear arsenal. They didn't want to pass them over to black people. And that's the only thing that ever did it. So my point in closing is that these programs, once they get rooted, are deeply rooted in nations, in the bureaucracy, in the scientists, in the funding, in the psyches of countries. And therefore, North Korea, it would seem to me, if the past is any precedent, is going to exact a very high price, one that we have no idea, no reason to believe the Bush administration is willing to pay if it is going to get out of the nuclear business. We've just had a very hot spring in Iraq. I'm very much afraid that it's going to be a much, much hotter summer in North Korea. Thank you.
Jonathan Schell, speaking at New York University Law School just a few days ago. And if you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back to a discussion of who pays for war? We'll look at the 50 states of this country and the budget deficits they face. Stay with us.
If we go to foreign soil to beat down the dogs of war, does this protect our homes from anything sniffing around our doors?
Curious, Jan Chris, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The worst budget crisis in half a century has forced states across the country to scrimp for savings in a style reminiscent of the Great Depression. Together, all 50 state governments are facing deficits of $30 billion this year, $82 billion next. In Massachusetts, the state cut health coverage for 36,000 of its poorest residents. Oregon has shortened the school year by 14 days and is cutting prescription drugs benefit for people with schizophrenia and mental illness. San Francisco plan cuts include the suspension of cost of living adjustments and aid to the disabled and seniors. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg plans to lay off more than 4,500 municipal workers. In response last night, more than 10,000 2,000 people protested outside City Hall, among them Lillian Roberts, executive director of DC 37.
The war is taking a lot out of the budgets of the city. And you can't help anybody else if you can't help your own. And we're making a statement that we have to have a living wage. We have to be able to pay the taxes and keep the economy going. We shop among the small businesses in our neighborhood, and we have to keep them viable for ourselves. So charity starts at home.
Lillian Roberts, executive director of the union DC 37, speaking in New York. In New York, Mayor Bloomberg plans to close 8 firehouses next month. The firefighters union has won at least a temporary reprieve from the city's plan to cut staff at 49 engine companies. This comes in light of the September 11th attacks in the World Trade Center, in which 343 firefighters died. Joining us on the line right now is Stephen Cassidy, president of the Uniform Firefighters Association. Can you talk about the significance of these cuts, Mr. Cassidy?
Well, the cuts to the fire department would be devastating. Post 9/11, the world changed. New York City remains the number one target for terrorists. And the way that fire departments, and especially this fire department, it needs to be prepared to respond to possible terrorist attacks, requires that we do things differently, that we have additional training, that we have specialized units. This is on the heels of massive retirements and 343 firefighters killed. So we have a much younger department. We need additional resources to have the specialized training and equipment. For example, attacks on subways, if God forbid, this is something we never thought could happen, and clearly it's something we need to be prepared for. You need firefighters that have chemical protective clothing that can go down there and rescue victims. We don't have enough units that have that, either the clothing or the training, and this is something that requires additional resources. So I know the mayor has a real budget crisis at this point in time, but if the fire department doesn't have the resources to do what it needs to do, we'll look back after there is an attack or a disaster and say, why weren't we better prepared?
We're going to turn now to Greg Speeder, who's executive director of the National Priorities Project in Western Massachusetts. You've been looking at all 50 states. You have a very interesting website, nationalpriorities.org, that breaks down the states and where tax dollars are being spent for war and here at home. Can you talk about this national picture and then give us a city example?
Well, it's scary across, as you've said, across the country. All states are in fiscal crisis. And just as an example, I think these cuts all end up affecting cities and towns. And just as one example, we've done some work in New Haven, Connecticut. This is a city that's lost 40% of its manufacturing jobs over the last several decades, has a child poverty rate of 33%. Workers, people are having to work 2 or 3 jobs just to survive, and yet we're finding that in November the state cut the aid to that city, so that the city had to cut 126 employees, and then again just in March they had to cut another 110 employees just in the school department alone. So cities are being clobbered by this. They're ending up having to pay for the war. The war we were just hearing from New York City cost New York City about $2.6 billion, and yet we're now talking about tax breaks, especially for very wealthy people, that will eat up another $15 to $30 billion a year, primarily for people who make $1 million a year or more. So there is money out there. But when we're talking about providing tax breaks for certain income levels and providing offshore corporate tax dodges at $70 billion a year, then we're not going to have the services that our cities and towns need.
You know, someone said 1 in 3 children in Iraq are in poverty. Maybe people would believe it in this country. But if you said 1 in 3 kids in New Haven are in poverty.
There are 30 cities that have over 30% child poverty rates. and one out of every 10 counties in the United States has a child poverty rate of 30% or more.
We're also joined by Meju Luik, joining us from Boston with United for a Fair Economy. Millions of low-income Americans face the loss of health insurance or sharp cuts in benefits like coverage for prescription drugs and dental care. Meju Luik, you actually used to be a cafeteria worker in Boston Hospital. Can you talk about this?
Yes, just in general, the health cuts are all over the place. We had fought over many years to expand medical benefits to poor people, and those are being cut, which really affects and puts a huge cramp on the very few public hospitals we have left, especially community health centers. They're all being sent to community health centers, but there are no federal dollars to keep that open. Benefits to legal immigrants are being cut as well. So in Colorado, for example, 3,500 legal immigrants are losing their benefits. And at a time when they're talking about SARS and other kinds of things, obviously, germs don't carry green cards, as we used to say. It makes no sense not to give basic health benefits to everyone. I wanted to just say that in economy, the word economy means management of a household. It comes from a Greek word. And if you think about your household, you might be somewhat concerned about security. You might be concerned about those types of things, but you really need to meet your basic needs. You have to think about your future in terms of education, retirement, and so on, and you do need a little bit of fun and leisure. Right now, if you look at the U.S. budget, we spend $396 billion in terms of defense and security. That's really like if you had the bars on the window, the alarm, the chain-link fence, the guns under the pillow, the ADAC tag dog, the whole nine yards. And we only spend $29 billion on housing assistance, which is what people need to meet their basic needs. In terms of planning for the future, only $52 billion goes for education, our future, our children. But then it's interesting if you look at that fun and leisure category. With the tax cuts, it is like giving back a lot of money to the rich. It's like if dad in your household says, yeah, I'm going to buy all those chain link fences and so on, and I'm going to buy a new yacht, and too bad, kids, there's nothing left for your college education, and too bad, there's no food in the refrigerator. So this really makes no sense. I think that if we look at the real agenda of this administration, it's clear that Grover Norquist, who said he wanted to shrink government to the size where you could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub, that is really becoming true, but only in the sense of the parts of government that build our social infrastructure.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Meju Luik, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, for joining us, and Greg Speeder of the National Priorities Project. We'll certainly continue this program and this discussion. The number to call if you want a copy of the show, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Tomorrow, a special on May Day. We will bring you the reading of People's History of the United States. Howard Zinn has now sold 1 million copies, and among those who will be reading, James Earl Jones, Harris Yulin, Marissa Tomei, Danny Glover, Kurt Vonnegut, Alfre Woodard, Alice Walker. Our website, democracynow.org. Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman.